This podcast is brought to you by Kefir Her. Whether you're feeling the effects of menopause or your menstrual cycle, discover what's key for you in less than 5 minutes with tailored supplement recommendations, information and insights on kefirher.com.
Hi, I'm Renee.
And I'm Donna. Welcome to the Key for Her podcast.
In this series, we aim to educate and open up honest conversations with both medical professionals and real-life women.
We want to shine a light on those topics that sometimes go unspoken about and help empower women to know what is key for their health and well-being.
Welcome back to the Key for Her podcast. And today we have the fabulous Dr. Kiva Hartley back on with us. And we are talking all about HRT. A lot of you have had questions about it and you've sent them into us. And we are going to go through them for an in-depth chat about HRT and everything there is to know about it. So we shall get started.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good. Great to have you back again.
Absolutely. So where do you want to start? It's a big topic, isn't it?
It's huge. We have about 35 to 40 minutes to cover.
To cover all of it. Okay, so it's a whistle-stop tour of
A to Z of HRT. But I have a few little notes here, so I'm going to go through them. And I suppose what we're thinking about is the average woman who might be in perimenopause, and looking at it from her perspective, you know, she might know a little bit about HRT. She might feel, a bit confused. It seems like a big minefield of stuff to understand. But really, when you explain it all, you know, it's not that hard to understand. Yeah. So shall we?
Yeah, you can sort of break it down into something that is a bit more digestible and easy to understand. But it is, I mean, HRT is complicated. I think, you know, I'm still learning every day. It is complicated. I think, you know, it's important to kind of maybe kick off by saying that HRT is hormone replacement therapy, and it is really effective, and it is the route that a lot of women choose to go, but that there are other routes of managing these symptoms and looking at long-term health as well. And it's not in any, you know, in any way that it's HRT or nothing or HRT for everybody. It's, but I think we had wanted to maybe have a proper discussion to look at HRT specifically, but just to kind of lay it out, look, I acknowledge that there are other very, acceptable, very effective routes that people might choose to take that are not hormone replacement therapy. But for those who do go down this route,
like a pick and mix, like you said before, like that you give everyone all their options and then between themselves and their doctor, they can come up with a plan that's kind of tailored to them.
Yeah, the way I look at it is that, look, a lot of the symptoms that occur, whether that's perimenopause and you're still having periods or it's menopause and you're not having periods anymore, like no matter where you are in the spectrum, this sort of constellation of symptoms that you get that are so individual from no symptoms at all for some people, their periods stop and they feel fantastic and that's great. And then the other end of the spectrum and the poor women who sort of tick every box in the symptom checker. So no matter where you are in the spectrum, those symptoms, a lot of them are hormonal, but a lot of them are complex. If you look at things like mood and libido, it's often not just down to one specific issue. It's not just hormonal, or it might not, just be, stressors in their life. It's often just a combination of all these things. And so the answer, therefore, is not in one thing either. Yeah. And so one hormone is not going to fix everything. And that's why we draw on, look at all the supports and all the tools that are out there.
I think the word as well, manage expectations as well, because I think for some people, they might think that it's a cure-all, but it's more of a holistic approach to diet and wellness and lifestyle, and perhaps adding in HRT as part of that.
It's just one tool in your toolbox. That's what it is. And I think coming at a problem. Like mood is kind of the, one of the classic ones that we really, I feel strongly that people should come at it from a few different angles. Look at lifestyle, reduce your alcohol, increase your, like all the stuff you know you should be doing, increase your exercise. But look at things like counseling and CBT, and HRT is part of that. And non-hormonal medications like antidepressants may be part of it too. It just depends on the person. But for the purposes of today, I suppose it's hormone therapy that we're kind of focusing on.
Yeah.
Okay. So basically, like, it trips people up a lot, because basically when you say HRT, you're talking about, you know, lots of different medications that are all under this umbrella term of hormone replacement therapy. It's not just one medication. And there's loads of different combinations. That's one of the problems. So the fundamental sort of building blocks of your HRT are a combination of estrogen and then a second hormone, progestogen. And where it gets confusing is that women who've had a hysterectomy, if you had your womb removed, most of those women take estrogen on its own. So you kind of, even from the very beginning, you can split it into these two groups, estrogen only HRT versus estrogen and a second hormone, progestogen. Estrogen only if you have no womb, and you take both hormones if you still have your womb. Okay. Then look at women who are either perimenopausal. So these are women who still have ovarian production of some of these hormones. But instead of, I hope this comes across in the camera, instead of this kind of, you know, when you hit menopause and your ovaries are just, they're not doing,
they're much. Flatlining.
Well, for estrogen, they're flatlining. For estradiol, they're flatlining. Yeah, and you're doing this. Whereas in perimenopause, typically you'd see maybe a small dick, an overproduction. You know, a month or two where you're okay again, maybe a couple of bad months in a row, just very erratic. So we split these, we split women into two categories, women who are still having periods or who haven't gone a full year with no bleed. And then we have our postmenopausal women who've gone a full year with no bleed. And the women who get really confused are women who maybe have a coil, like a Mirena coil.
Yes.
They come in saying, okay, I have a coil. Which of these two groups am I in? And the truth is, we don't know.
We don't know. Yeah.
But we typically treat them as if they're postmenopausal, but that's, we'll come to that. Anyway, for women who don't have a coil and haven't had a hysterectomy, yeah, we split them into those two groups. Okay. And so the big difference when it comes to hormone therapy is if you're perimenopausal, you're going to take your progestogen, that second hormone, for 2 weeks a month. And we'd expect you to maybe still get a period every month.
If and when you say 2 weeks a month, which days out of the month do you take it?
Yeah, so that also complicated, and I totally understand how that trips people up. It trips us up, I think, as well. In a perfect world, if we were able to kind of get a magnifying glass and go in and look and see what your ovaries are doing, a magnifying glass wouldn't do that, would it? Anyway, some sort of laparoscopy, go in and have a look at your ovaries and see what they're doing. What we would ideally like to do is to line up with your own cycle. So you would take your estrogen only, those 2 weeks where it's estrogen on its own, for the first 2 weeks of your cycle, as in from the first day of your period for 2 weeks. And then the 2 weeks that are after that, you would take your estrogen and progestin, because that's mimicking what a normal cycle is.
Yeah.
The problem is the people we're talking about here, these perimenopausal women, the majority of them do not have a regular cycle. And so it's kind of impossible to do that. What we're using that second hormone for, your progestogen has only one job, which is actually just to stop you getting womb cancer. It's to protect the lining of your womb. If I give someone with a womb estrogen, no matter what age they are, what stage in all of this they are, if I give them estrogen on its own, estrogen will thicken the lining of the womb. It's like fertilizer. That's what it's supposed to do in those first 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. That thick, the lining gets thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker. And then naturally, if we ovulate, we produce our own progestogen, which stops that thickening in its tracks for 2 weeks, changes the lining a little bit so that something can implant.
Okay.
So that's what we want to mimic.
It also makes us feel nice and calm. That nice.
It depends on the person. Some people get really bad PMS symptoms from progestogen. Hey. That's genetic. So it just depends on the person. But that's it. With, if you're looking at HRT, that's what we're doing. We're giving you progestogen so that you don't get this endless thickening in the lining of the womb, because that can lead to womb cancer.
Yeah.
What we know is that you need a minimum of 2 weeks, well, it's actually 12 days per month to stop womb cancer from happening if you're taking estrogen.
Okay.
So really, we don't care when you take it. If you end up taking it, you know, at the wrong time, if you like, in inverted commas, during your cycle, the only bad thing that might happen is that you get a breakthrough bleed or a bit of spotting. But the goal here is to stop you getting womb cancer. And if you take 2 weeks, 12 days of progestogen per month, you will be fine. What I do, so the easiest way to, if you're still on periods, if you're perimenopausal and you're starting HRT, I ask women, start first day of your next period, start your estrogen.
Yeah.
2 weeks later, add in your progestogen, but look at the calendar and see what date of the month that is. So say it's the 10th of November, whatever. On the 10th of every month, take 2 weeks of progestin.
Okay, that's a good way to...
Now, I have stolen that from Dr. Rachel Mackey, this wonderful, brilliant women's health specialist who works in Dunleary. So I have to give her credit. She had told me, this is what I tell patients. I was like, that's actually much simpler than what we were doing. So I've kind of stolen her method. I think it's a really good way of doing it. Yeah. So that sort of makes it easier. And then the expectation is that you will end up eventually getting a somewhat regular bleed. If you're postmenopausal, you've stopped having periods, you start your estrogen and progestin at the same time, but you take your progestin every single day.
Okay. And so it's all month long.
Exactly. And we don't expect you to have periods if you're doing that. The first 3 to 6 months after you start HRT is no man's land. You can get irregular bleeding. You can have spotting. If you're postmenopausal, you can have a recurrence. You can go back to having some bleeding. Mm-hmm. That is all completely normal in the first 6 months.
Okay. I think that's a question that some people are concerned about, is that they're afraid of what those first few months are going to look like, but they're not necessarily all bad. That for some people, you know, it can work really well for them quickly, and it can be a very positive experience with little tweaking, and to add it in gradually. Like I've heard that, you know, for some people that might be asking for testosterone, possibly with it, that wouldn't be added in even for first couple of months, or would they just start with estrogen and progesterone?
Yeah, that's what I'm sure everybody practices a little bit differently, but that's our approach. So testosterone is the third hormone that your ovaries produce, but you don't lose testosterone the way that you lose the estrogen. Mm-hmm. If you think of getting to menopause, even through perimenopause, and your estrogen is just all over the place, too much sometimes and too little at other times, and then sort of less and less as time goes on, and then you hit your final period and then you just stop producing it. And the same with the second hormone, progestin. Once you stop ovulating, you're not producing progesterone anymore.
Okay.
Testosterone, you actually continue to produce testosterone through your 50s, and it doesn't matter when your last period happens. There's no relationship between a change in your testosterone levels and when your last period has happened. It's not a sudden decline. So testosterone is a lot more complicated and nuanced, and we've less data, and there's probably less health benefits. So I would park that and get the basics right from the beginning.
First,
I also don't like the thought of starting three new medications all at once, because it's, to borrow a phrase that my husband uses sometimes, it's like asking what bean made you fart. So you don't know what made you feel better, what made you feel worse. It's already complicated starting two hormones at once. Hmm. So we try to not make it more complicated. Yeah.
I suppose the next question we have is, let's discuss a bit about vaginal estrogen and the symptoms that women can be experiencing, and why it could be a really great one to add into their routine if you see fit.
Yeah. So the old fashioned term was vaginal atrophy, which is a horrible, like typical medical term.
It's sounds like your insides are falling out.
Yeah. Oh, you're all kind of crinkled up and all. Yeah. Like it's a horrible expression. And the newer kind of more modern term is genitourinary symptoms of menopause, which is probably more accurate. But basically all we're referring to is that when you lose estrogen, the vaginal tissue and the tissue, like the tissue in your bladder, like your muscle, your detrusor muscle in your bladder, and your urethra, which is the tube that goes from the bladder to the outside, that whole area is covered in estrogen receptors. So when you lose estrogen, it starts to go through changes. And typically we see thinning of the vaginal membranes or walls, and the tissue becomes thinner. It becomes quicker to tear, so it loses its elasticity. So if you think, like, previously when you were premenopausal, if you like, it's nice and stretchy, there's a bit of give. It has to be, if you think of what it does, you know, what it's for. It needs like it. Anyway, that's gone. And so instead of stretching, it just tears or rips. So with sex, you'll find hairing happening, really uncomfortable. The vaginal canal itself actually shrinks and shortens a bit. The pH changes, so we get different bacteria living there, and so on. And it's drier, and you know, there's a lot of change. Vaginal estrogen, localized vaginal estrogen, so that's usually a little pessary or cream, or there's pessaries that come with an applicator. There's different forms. It stays, it gets absorbed into the vaginal tissue, but it stays in that region. It's really good for your urethra, your bladder, urine symptoms like leaking and urgency and frequency and those things that we see. Comfort with sex, vaginal discomfort in general. A lot of women find that, you know, I'm itchy and sore like I never used to.
For no particular reason, even though perhaps like any tests would come back negative for thrush or a UTI or anything.
Number of women I talk to who say, oh, I've recurrent thrush, and I've taken, I don't know how much, I'm keeping Caniston in business, and I go in and I get a new Caniston thing every month, and it's not thrush at all.
Yeah.
And thrush gets less likely as you get older. The chance of you getting thrush is just that bit less likely.
Yeah.
The pH changes that we see, that like yeast, candida, which is what causes thrush, it doesn't like this new low estrogen environment. So,
so you're less likely to
get less likely. Yeah.
So
much more likely that it's atrophy, you know?
Yeah. It is more likely. Yeah. Okay.
Vaginal estrogen, it's not HRT. I think that's, you know, kind of really important to drive at home that.
Yeah. I think people have this, and I know we need to talk about this as well. They just think HRT.
Yeah.
And perhaps, say at my age now, if I had mentioned this to my mom, she'd be there, oh no, because a lot of that generation just had a blanket no, and they were fearful of it. And HRT has changed so much over the years. They're obviously not using this pre-Marin or Mare's urine one that we've heard of before, all these scare stories, but it's come on so much. And it's obviously being used in much safer ways, you know, transdermally on the skin, and how it can be absorbed that way. And I suppose I'd like to chat a little bit about why were they worried at the time, and how now so much research has been done on it. And I've heard HRT as being called health restorative treatment, you know, it's almost like what HRT, it's the new meaning of HRT, health restorative, because it has so many benefits. And let's discuss some of these old wives' tales, or why they were concerned about it before.
Yeah. Okay. If you rewind like the history of HRT, if you go all the way back, so they isolated in the lab, they were able to manufacture estrogen from the 1940s onwards. And then in the 60s, it became sort of prescribable. And by the time we got to the late 80s, early 90s, Premarin, so pregnant mare's urine, Premarin.
I have visions of how they were possibly collecting it. But anyway, it's strange.
I say a bit like you don't want to know where half your food comes from. You probably don't want to know where half your medication comes from. You know, there was nothing wrong with Premarin at the time. And one of the things about Premarin, it's really effective, really potent. You feel amazing on it. And so it was the most commonly prescribed medication in the States in the early 90s.
Yeah.
I think it's mind-boggling, you know. So the change happened because of there were two big studies. There was the Million Women study, which is in the UK, and then there was another study called the Women's Health Initiative, which was an American study, and it was massive. Like it was like hundreds of thousands of women. It was enormous.
Yeah.
And they took all these women, they looked at, they were all on HRT, and they compared them to women who were not taking hormone therapy. And then those results got published in the early 90s, 1992.
Okay.
And
bang in the middle of when my mom probably really needed it.
There you go. Yeah. And the media ran with this. And there were these, like the headlines, if you look at the newspaper headline, banner headlines from 1992 about HRT, they're terrifying. I wouldn't take HRT, you'd be running a mile. And so it was all breast cancer, breast cancer, breast cancer, breast cancer. Everybody got taken off HRT. And if you look at the trends over the next few years, the HRT prescribing rates went down by 60, 70%.
That's huge.
Massive. And by the time we're in the late 90s, very few people were taking it. So what then happened was the study continued, and they continued to follow these women up, and the results were republished in 2012. So basically a group of, you know, scientists went back and looked at stuff and nitpicked through the results a bit more detail in 2012 with longer follow-up, and quietly published like a we're kind of wrong and that wasn't really right. And actually, now that we look at it through this sort of light, we see things a bit differently. And we had more modern medication coming on board or coming online at that point as well. And that changed the landscape. But it's taken 10 years for that new information from 2012 to trickle down into actual practice.
Yeah, it takes a long time.
So the kind of whistle stop of, you know, the Women's Health Initiative, the big criticisms of it, the main thing is the average age of women in the WHI was 63. That's the first starting HRT, not just her first prescription.
Okay.
And that's quite a bit older than the average woman that we would be starting on hormone therapy.
Yeah.
So that's the first criticism. And then there were all these other issues with it. But the other main thing was the hormones they used. And that's changed, just like you mentioned. So if you go back to, okay, most HRT is a combination of estrogen and progestin. So the estrogen they used in the WHI was Premarin, but it was a tablet form of estrogen. And so like you had mentioned about dermal estrogen, like through our skin, that's one of the big differences.
Yeah.
I still use tablet estrogen here and there for some women. It has a time and a place.
Okay.
But the majority of women now will take their estrogen, and you're taking estrogen to help, number one, symptoms, to see do you feel better. And number two, for some women, they get health benefit, particularly a reduction in bone density loss, which is what leads to osteoporosis.
Yes.
And number two, a reduction in cardiovascular risk,
which is really important as well. Yeah.
The killer of women in Ireland is cardiovascular disease. It's the thing you're most likely to die of if you're female.
Yeah.
And that reduction in risk from estrogen is small. It's not a huge dramatic drop in risk, but even a small reduction over thousands of women saves quite a number of lives.
Absolutely.
And basically, you're trying to stall the development of cardiovascular disease. So that's your estrogen, right? Anyway, if you take it through your skin, so your options are to take it as a patch or a gel or a spray, and we can go through them in a bit more detail if you want. And the difference with tablet form of estrogen is that it's going to be broken down and metabolized by your liver. And there's kind of knock-on effects to doing
that.
The big one is blood clotting and stroke. And so in the Women's Health Initiative, that's what they saw, an increased risk of blood clotting and stroke. With dermal estrogen, it has no impact on those risks at all. So it's much safer. And the second hormone in the WHI, what they used for their women who hadn't had a hysterectomy and had a womb, they gave them a thing called medoxyprogestogen acetate.
Okay.
And it's kind of a nasty type of progestogen. And we think it has higher risk of breast cancer. So if you look at the Women's Health Initiative, what they reported ultimately when they went back and looked at the results, were 4 to 8 extra breast cancers per 1,000 women after 5 years.
Yeah.
If they started their HRT in their 50s.
Right. And plus that was with a tablet that was...
You're taking it as a tablet or through your skin makes no difference to the breast cancer risk, but it does blood clotting risk.
Okay.
But that second hormone to protect their womb, the medoxyprogesterone acetate, that makes a difference to the breast cancer risk. Okay. Modern types of progestogen, the one we like to use most, is called micronized or body identical progesterone. Yeah. And we now know it has much less impact on breast cancer risk.
So your body is more likely to recognize it and absorb it, is it? Yeah.
I think your breast tissue is just less likely to promote the growth of abnormal cells if you're on this body identical progesterone. So there seems to be no doubt that it's safer from a breast cancer point of view. It's hard to compare it numbers wise to the Women's Health Initiative because we haven't done another study as big.
Okay.
To compare kind of almost head to head. We know that it is safer. So they're the two big differences.
Okay.
So if you come into me, just to kind of synopsize, I write the same prescription over and over and over again, 80% of the day, which is for estrogen, either in a gel, patch, or spray form. With this body identical progesterone, which is a capsule that most women take by mouth, although some insert vaginally, but the majority are taking it by mouth, either for 14 days a month because you're still having periods, or you're taking it every night because you stopped having periods. And that's sort of it.
That's it. Yeah. It's not the once you have it fully explained to you, it's not the big scary thing, or it's not as confusing as you might have thought before.
And I think because there's different brands and, you know, people do get confused. And, you know, so that there are variations on this. Some women take estrogen through their skin. And then in order to protect their womb, they might have a Mirena coil, which is also an acceptable way of, you know, getting that protection for your womb, but it's also very good birth control. If you've very heavy problematic periods, a Mirena coil essentially fixes that for a lot of women.
Yeah.
So that's one other option.
Yes.
And the last is there's a patch that has a combination of estrogen and a less breast-friendly progestin in it.
Okay.
So that option's there because of convenience. Obviously, it's easier to just slap on a patch. You change it twice a week, job done. It's all in one.
It obviously doesn't suit everybody. So that's why it's so important.
It's not my first go-to because the progestin in it isn't as breast-friendly as the alternative we had. But it is a good, convenient option for lots of women too.
Yeah.
So it depends on the person.
So say if someone is experiencing symptoms in their early 40s and they might have been to their own GP that they might be going to with the kids for years, and she's noticing that she has these symptoms, should she call ahead and say, who is the most, or which doctor in the clinic has the most interest in menopause care and perimenopause, or with extra training, should they ring ahead and ask for a particular doctor, or how should they go about visiting their doctor and being prepared before they go, as in, should they write down their symptoms first? But because if they're having brain fog, there's a chance that they could just become flustered, you know, during the appointment and not make the most out of the appointment. You know, I suppose it's about finding the right doctor for you that you connect with and you feel heard.
Yeah, that connection is really important. And some people have a fabulous relationship with their own GP, and so they're their first port of call, which is as it should be. I think there's no harm to sort of suss out, is there someone maybe in the clinic, if it's a multi-doctor clinic, is there someone who maybe has an interest in women's health and menopause specifically? What's handy, I find, when patients come in, having a timeline. Like when we ask you about your periods, I don't need to know exactly on what date what happened. I'm looking for just a sense over the last year of what has happened. Have you had, are they wildly all over the place? Are they regular as clockwork? Have you had no bleeding? But so having that information, knowing when your last period was, can be really handy too.
Yeah.
And then I would list your symptoms in order of what's bothering you the most.
The most. Okay.
So pick out the three or four or one or two or whatever things that are top of your list, and not the things you're most worried about, the things that are affecting your quality of life most. The other handy thing is to know family history. So again, I don't need to know your uncles and aunts and cousins unless there's a very specific common, you know, medical problem that's run through as a thread through those kind of more distant relatives, but particularly parents and your siblings.
Okay.
And it's usually breast cancer, a history of having a blood clot out of the blue in the family. Like if your mom had a blood clot, you know, in her leg or her lung, and anything else that you think might be relevant in your family history, just having that at your fingertips can be really handy in a consultation.
Yeah. And say if someone feels like they're not really connecting with their doctor, how do they go about finding someone like you? Or is there a register of where someone can even or look online to find let us say very perimenopause and menopause friendly doctors?
Yeah, and there's lots of us out there, you know,
that really specialize in it and can really connect, I suppose.
Yeah, I think there are, like, thankfully, if you'd asked me this question a couple of years ago, I think it would be a bit different. But thankfully now, there's been a huge surge in interest. The Irish College of General Practice, I do some teaching through them, and like, it's really well attended. And I think it just reflects that, I think, you know, GPs have an appetite for the most part to learn, to be really expert at this stuff. The Irish Menopause Facebook page is a good place to start for, like, they have 40 something thousand members. And I think they have a kind of directory or list that you can access through that Facebook page.
Okay.
Of doctors who have an interest in this or who specialize in it. You know, go to your own GP. Your GP might say, I'm not totally comfortable, or you're complicated, or I'm not totally comfortable with this.
Yeah.
And refer you on. I would get a couple of GP referrals or more per day, you know, from GPs all over the country. And I'd say a lot of the menopause specialists would say similar.
This podcast is brought to you by our very own brand, Key for Her. Whether you're feeling the effects of menopause or your menstrual cycle, discover what's key for you in less than 5 minutes with tailored supplement recommendations, information and insights on keyforher.com.
Please have 20% off on us by using the promo code KEYPODCAST in all capitals.
But I suppose GPs, they have to know a lot about a lot of things. And we can understand that like some of them mightn't be as specialized or have as much of an interest in it as other doctors. And I suppose it's great to know that the likes of you and your clinic is available where, you know, people can book in with you. And they might be confused. Do they have to bring their entire file from their own GP with them? Or can they just book in with you for an appointment and just then they can give you their medical history and you can work from there, you know, being specific about menopause care?
You can come in and like if something comes up during the consultation and if someone's sitting in front of me and I think, God, I need a bit more detail about that mm-hmm. specific issue. I mean, I contact their GP. We should be able to talk to each other. Or yeah. I'll write a letter to their GP saying, can you just, you know, I'm not sure about X, Y, or Z. Can you just clarify? So, you know, there should be communication there. Most of the GPs would have really good understanding of hormone therapy at this stage, but it's often just the slightly more complicated cases or women who are experiencing side effects or, you know, that get then referred on to us. I know what I was going to say. So the other place, thankfully, the other change that's happened in the last 12 months, there's now a public menopause clinic. So that's
great.
But there is another wonderful public menopause clinic opening up in the Rotunda next month. So so I'm heading up this clinic in the Rotunda. So that's really exciting. So I'll be there a full day a week, which is great. And we'll be taking referrals from the catchment area of the Rotunda Hospital.
So I suppose people, I know like with the government, they have a lot on their plate, but obviously there's other women that are concerned. When are these clinics popping up in the rest of the country? Do we have any idea when more are coming, or they're just focusing, I suppose, on Dublin in the main maternity hospitals? First?
I think Cork, they're in the process of establishing one in Cork. I actually don't know about other parts of the country, but at least there's some move towards, you know, opening up a public access clinic, which is great, I think. And so hopefully that, you know, it'll be successful and well supported, you know.
Yeah.
So there's loads of places to go, but it's good to know that the Rotunda and Hollis Street are both there, you know.
Yes, exactly.
The women can access them. And hopefully that will be rolled out to other parts of the country and everybody will have a local public clinic that they could go to.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Another question we have is, how many sessions would a patient need with you? How often, like, do they go back to you? What's an initial consultation like? How often do they need to go back and discuss how their HRT prescription is working for them? Because, say, for example, they might be having 20 hot flushes a day and then they're down to 8. So perhaps maybe their HRT needs to be tweaked. And how long do you leave them on?
Okay, so first visit is usually about 40 to 45 minutes long. And we go through a patient's history and we try to explore what symptoms and concerns and their expectations and all of those things at a first visit. And we talk about all of their options, not just HRT.
Yes.
And then usually, like obviously it varies from person to person, most women then will have a prescription, typically speaking, at the end of that consultation. If you're starting hormone therapy, we usually bring you back after 3 months for a review, and then it's every 6 months after that. What you can expect to happen at the review in particular, so we're looking for symptom control. We run through screening. When is your last mammogram? Is your smear up to date? Have you ever had a bone density? Do you need a bone density? And we look at bleeding pattern. So the thing that, like, when we talk about, when we're counseling women in terms of HRT, obviously, we talk about breast cancer, But I now have learned over the last few years, one of the really important things to counsel women on is bleeding, bleeding pattern, what to expect with bleeding, because it is the biggest side effect. One of the biggest issues we run into is bleeding. And that, I mean, by far probably creates the biggest headache at the review visits. It's the biggest problem. Breast cancer risk of HRT is dependent really on what progestin we're using, which goes back to saying, look, we tend to use progestins now that are much more breast friendly, and it's duration. And that's why we don't run into this kind of, like, that's why it's not an issue at every review visit. Yeah. You know, it's duration related. So, you know, short-term use of HRT, which is up to 5 years, carries a small but not significant risk of breast cancer. So it's something that's going to occur. The longer women are on HRT, that risk becomes more significant. But in the short term, it's bleeding. Bleeding is the issue.
Okay.
So heavier bleeding, or I'm getting breakthrough bleeding, or my periods are really irregular. And my job is then to figure out, number one, what to do about it. And number two, does it need to be investigated? And so one of the biggest risks with starting hormone therapy is that you'll end up with some bleeding that then needs an ultrasound, and then maybe you have to go to gynecology.
Okay.
And that's an issue. So that's, be prepared at your review visit. We will be asking, what has your bleeding pattern been like? Have you had any bleeding? Have you not? How heavy is it? And so on.
Okay.
And then we do it. The first thing we usually do is a pelvic exam. We check that your smear is up to date. If you have a new sexual partner, we rule out an STI and so on. And we do a pelvic ultrasound to look at the lining of your womb if we need to.
Okay. Okay. Well, that all makes sense. We have another question here as well. How quickly can people expect HRT to work or to start to see the effects? How long is a piece of string, huh? Once they start? I know it's different for everybody, but ballpark perhaps.
I think it really depends on what your symptoms are. It depends on what you're treating. Vasomotor symptoms, which is the medical term for hot flushes and night sweats, they respond for most women, and not for everybody, but for the vast majority, they respond really well.
Yeah.
It's like flicking a switch. It's beautiful. It's so satisfying, you know. And that would happen.
The person that comes into you for the first appointment is not really the person that may come in for the second appointment. They're in.
Often.
It's great.
I like suppose the fact that they can be unrecognizable to us. Like,
yes.
You know, you've slept for the first time, however long. But they come in with a smile, you know, which is really, again, really gratifying. But yeah, so I would say the physical symptoms, so joint aches and pains, maybe headaches, but definitely hot flushes and night sweats should have some improvement in the first 2 weeks. Okay. And what we do is we start everybody in a low dose of estrogen initially. Your progestin, if you're on it, is standardized because we're using it to protect your womb. So that's one dose, if you like.
Yes.
Your estrogen, though, we start low dose. And at the 3 month review, if you come in and say, I was having 20 hot flushes, but now I'm having 5 or 6 a day. Okay, well, maybe we like inch up your estrogen a little and see. And as we go up on estrogen, your symptoms should be better controlled, but only to a point.
It's important, though, for someone not to just give themselves an extra pump and self increase. It's really important to do that.
Don't go rogue. Don't go rogue.
They're not allowed. No extra pumps of their estrogen.
Well, so one of the nice things about if you're looking at estrogen types, there's the patch, which you apply on your lower back, your bum, or your tummy, and you change it twice a week. So you pick 2 days a week and you change your patch those days. And they're waterproof and you can shower and swim, etc., with them on. That's grand. The other options, so they're gel and the spray for your estrogen, they're daily applications. I have a small preference for the daily applications, if I'm honest. And one of the nice things about the gel, for example, is that you can increase your dose a little, but don't go rogue. So usually we discuss at the first visit, look, start with, for example, one pump of gel, and that's usually applied to the outside of your arm, or some people put it on their thigh. And if in 4 weeks' time you feel my hot flushes are still there, or I'm still waking with night sweats, you increase it to either a little bit extra or even a full pump extra on the other arm.
Okay.
But then stop and then wait until we talk before we go any further.
Yeah.
And there's a point with estrogen, if you're on too much, you feel worse.
Yes. I think a lot of people need to know that to stop smothering themselves and thinking.
Yeah, like all over. Yeah.
It's a bottle of the fountain of youth. No, there's this, I suppose that the point of no return where it has maybe an opposite effect. So I think, yes, that's an important one, for no self prescribing extra light, chatting to your doctor first.
Yeah, slathering it on, like all a big bath of estrogen. Yeah. You won't necessarily feel better just because you've done that. We do see side effects with starting these hormones. So breast tenderness is probably one of the most common ones. A bit of bloating or headaches can be common in the first few weeks as well.
Yeah.
Other than that, they're generally well tolerated because, like you mentioned earlier, like these are hormones that your body, if we're using the most common ones that we use at the beginning, they're hormones that your body kind of recognizes. Mm-hmm. But it's just about getting that dose right. And that's why we do these reviews. We check that everything is ticking along as it should be.
Yeah. And for some people, some people might experience brain fog or anxiety as well. And how soon can they possibly see an improvement in those symptoms? Because I think that those two are kind of ones that are mentioned a lot to us. There's a lot of anxious women out there that all of a sudden they're they're driving on the M50 and they're afraid to merge into the other lane. All of a sudden it feels a bit overwhelming and they don't really know why, or they don't want to be driving at nighttime. I know Davina McCall has said this as well, that kind of anxiety can take over, and how soon can they notice a difference possibly in an improvement in that?
Yeah, that's probably harder to pin down. Anxiety and mood may take a bit longer to improve, probably because they're multifactorial, and for some women the answer is not going to be just getting the right dose of estrogen. For some women it will be, and if we, you know, within the first few weeks that anxiety starts to fade away, which is just like this weight being lifted off your chest for a lot of women. And for others, you know, they need a combination of something like an anti-anxiety medication, like an antidepressant, in addition to their HRT. And that's fine too. But it depends on the person.
Depends,
so we'd say 3 months is probably a good trial to really know how you feel on that particular dose with that particular route. What was the other thing you mentioned? Anxiety and brain fog. Cognitive changes with menopause are probably one of the most challenging things to treat.
Okay.
That's where setting those realistic expectations comes in.
And it is one better off starting earlier because of...
I think I can't really back that up with science at this point, but that's the suspicion, is that probably starting HRT in perimenopause before your periods have totally stopped may ultimately have better impact on cognition long-term. If you did nothing when it comes to cognition, if you didn't take HRT, most women, their brain fog, their cognitive symptoms will improve with time. But that could be 5 years. It could be 7 years. The time frame can be really wide.
It might be too much when they're possibly in the height of their career and they need to be on top of their game, and they want to feel their best.
True. And I suppose if you look at, you know, a lot of women, if they're very symptomatic, they might not be sleeping, they're awake with some women have night sweats and so on. And fixing that will often be reflected then in an improvement in their cognitive function and mood. But women who come in, like I definitely have patients, I cannot understand why all of these other symptoms have improved, but their brain fog persists. And it's so frustrating for both them and me, more so for them, obviously, but it is really frustrating. Like I don't know. And no matter how much we go up in their estrogen, it does, but that's rare, I have to say. The majority of women probably do see an improvement in cognition. Yeah.
Yeah. And I suppose with the sleep as well, everything else tends to improve as well. If they've had a good sleep, they tend to feel so much better. So we're coming to the end of it. And I know at the end of all of our podcasts, we always say, what are your three key tips for people, I suppose, considering HRT or, you know, thinking about it? What are your tips about it?
So I think myth busting is probably the handiest thing to do at this point. Mm-hmm. So number one, I get asked a lot, am I too early to start HRT? And I think it's important to know that it needs to be used appropriately. So we shouldn't be using it in younger women who are not going to get benefit because their symptoms are not hormonal to begin with. But outside of that, no, there is no limit on age in terms of youth. You know, if you're symptomatic, if you're perimenopausal, you can start your HRT at any point. Okay. Equally, on the other end of the spectrum, there's no upper limit in terms of age, but we're increasingly cautious in older women because of risk. So it's just a discussion to have, but there isn't an actual barrier on either side when it comes to age. Number two is, I get asked a lot, you know, can I only take it for 5 years? And if I take it early, do I then, like, am I then using up my chips for my 5-year quota of HRT? And then when I really need it, I won't be able to take it. So that's not true either. For women under 50, the impact that HRT has on breast cancer risk is really small, because you have these hormones for the most part anyway. So we don't actually count your years of exposure to HRT till you get to 50. Okay. Even at 55, if you've taken 5 years, we still don't draw a line in the sand and say you have to stop it. We have to. We don't.
You say how it goes. Each
time you get out of your hands, like, no, not at all. It's an annual discussion, individual discussion about how much benefit you're getting versus where you are in terms of risk. And a lot of women safely take HRT for the rest of their lives. That's important to know. Mm-hmm. My very last point, a lot of women ask about, you know, if I'm not having symptoms at all, should I be on HRT?
Yeah.
That's a bit more complicated. And at this minute in time, and it may change, unless you've osteoporosis, if you have no symptoms, no, you shouldn't be on HRT is what the current guidelines are.
Okay.
So only used to control menopausal, perimenopausal and menopausal symptoms, and to reduce osteoporosis risk.
Yeah.
And outside of that, we look at lifestyle and other options. But yeah, like, well, it's a discussion, you know.
It is. And I think that's exactly what it is. It's a discussion, and it evolves over time, that, you know, what works for your friend mightn't necessarily work for you. And it's about making those regular appointments, you know, with your doctor, just to check up on your health overall, not just, you know, visiting just about perimenopause symptoms, but just to make sure that something else, you know, isn't sinister in the background, that, you know, you're keeping on top of your overall health. But I think that was really informative. And I think a lot of people will get a lot of benefit from that as well. And hopefully it helps to demystify a bit about HRT. And yeah, thank you so much for coming on today.
Not at all.
Talking to us.
Okay.
Looking forward to having you back soon.
Me too. Okay. All the best, Renee. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Key for Her podcast. We'd be so grateful if you could hit subscribe, rate, and share this podcast with your friends.
For tips, tricks, and hacks on all things perimenopause, menopause, periods, menstrual cycles, and skin health, follow us at Key for Her on TikTok and Instagram.
Check out our website, keyforher.com, for more information.